What will it take to stem the rate of accidents among pilots transitioning to fast modern aircraft? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. It's Monday. That means it's time to hear from Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. Bob also operates a flight training facility in Western New York at the Buffalo Lancaster Airport called Bob Miller Flight Training. Bob, thanks for taking some time out to talk to our listeners today.
As always, Paul, I consider it a pleasure.
In the current edition of Over the Airwaves, you wrote about a pair of accidents that happened in fairly rapid succession that had a number of marked similarities, and it led you to some conclusions and opinions regarding the qualifications of people being put into high-performance carbon composite aircraft, noting that the safety features that are incorporated in these planes in an attempt to mitigate getting over our heads aren't necessarily always effective. Tell us about the two accidents that got you on this topic.
Well, anytime we experience accidents personally, when they occur either in our own backyard or they involve people that we know, and when there are fatalities involved, each of us takes a heightened interest in what took place. In this particular instance, we had two high-performance singles that were occupying the same hangar right here in our own town. These two happen to be involving Cirrus SR-22s, but that's not the object of my wrath on this, because I took a rather heated point of view on why these happened, simply because there were several common factors in each of these accidents that I think really help to point the finger at what we need to do as pilots if we're going to transition from traditional metal airplanes into fast glass airplanes.
Let's talk about what some of those similarities were, other than the make of airplane. Pilots had some similarities in their backgrounds.
Yeah, in each of these cases, the pilots had extensive experience in the traditional round gauge metal airplanes, and very little experience at the time of the accidents in their carbon composite airplanes. Number one. Number two, they had acquired these high performance airplanes within 6 months of experiencing a fatal accident. Number three, each of these pilots flew relatively infrequently. Each flew less than once a month. Fourth, one of the systems that I think is a remarkably effective system, it should be, and that's the ballistic recovery system that's on the Cirrus SR-22. It just happened coincidentally in both of these fatal accidents. The system was not effective in helping to save lives. I'm not saying the system was defective. We don't know yet whether or not the pilot actually activated the system.
Okay, now, I guess this brings me to a quandary. It seems to me that technology is always going to march forward. Manufacturers, to stay competitive, are always going to want to put the latest technology and capability into their product. And it's not just aviation, it's automobiles and everything else. It almost seems to me that no matter what manufacturers do to try to protect us from ourselves, we reach a point where we can't be protected anymore, where it only serves to make us more complacent. Is that part of the problem here?
I think you said it, Paul. The ballistic recovery system is a wonderful system. Equipping an airplane with known ICE certification is a wonderful add-on. But if we as pilots use these enhancements as an excuse not to maintain our proficiency, and we feel more comfortable buying into these airplanes because there's certain design features which ought to mitigate or protect us in the event of our own lack of skills, I think that's where there is indeed a real problem. We've discussed this many times, you and I, Paul, as to what the role of the autopilot should be. Should an autopilot, and this has been around for 60 years, should that be a substitute for pilot skills? Of course not. And I think where we run into problems is when the customer is swayed by a manufacturer, regardless of who the manufacturer is, and is led to believe, listen, if things get tough up there, reach up, pull the handle, you're going to be okay. Or if you have a chance encounter with icing conditions, go ahead, continue to barrel on in that same direction, because after all, we've got a certification for known ice, you're going to be okay, you can go through that. Well, both of those factors are not applicable. And if we use these, as I said, as a substitute for maintaining our proficiency, I think the accident record is beginning to show that that this, in fact, is happening.
If you could build an aircraft out of foam rubber that could survive terminal velocity into a pile of rocks, someone would still find a way to get hurt in it.
Yeah, they would. But then they would complain that the airplane goes too slow.
Well, right.
You know, and to the manufacturer's credit, I mean, the G1000 setup that that is now in many of the modern airplanes, you cannot run out of gas in that airplane. You simply cannot. I mean, you'd have to be deaf and blind to ignore the warning systems that come out of the panel anytime you're even remotely close to running out of fuel. Mm-hmm. That's a tremendous enhancement. And according to some of the air safety data I've seen, it has actually been effective in reducing the number of fuel exhaustion accidents that we're seeing. But one of the problems I'm seeing with the ballistic chute is that pilots are maybe they're not practicing stalls the way they used to in the conventional airplane. Maybe we're not practicing slow flight for fear that, hey, if this airplane should enter an inadvertent stall spin, is it recoverable? The manufacturer says, well, you know, if you get into a stall spin that's not recoverable, pull the chute. Well, how do you practice something like that?
Yeah. It's, I mean, you'd have to be in a simulator.
Yeah, right.
Well, when we come back from the break, Bob, let's talk about what we do, what maybe we can do, what would be appropriate things to try to turn this thing around. Bob Miller is my guest. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. And we're talking about modern aircraft, their capabilities, some of the safety features that at times seem frustratingly ineffective in reducing the GA accident rate. And Bob, I guess the question is, if pilots are getting into more sophisticated aircraft and they're not proficient enough or have not had enough training in type, that sort of thing, what is the remedy? How far do we go? Do we need the FAA to come down with a ton of bricks? Should the insurance companies be more aggressive in discounting the kinds of training and proficiency that will make us less prone to accidents? Or do we need type ratings in propeller aircraft, as odd as that sounds to some people?
Well, yeah, all three, all four, perhaps, and nobody wants to see more regulation. The manufacturers certainly do not want to see added burdens, or nor does AOPA need to see added burdens. But I think there needs to be a heightened awareness, and however we achieve that, that's what we need. Transitioning from a Cessna 172 to a Cessna 182, and even up to a 210, or transitioning from a Piper Warrior to a Piper Archer to a Piper Saratoga, those transitions are nowhere similar to the transition we face between any of those airplanes and what the FAA is now calling the fast glass airplanes. The Cessna Corvallis, formerly called the 400, Cessna 400, and the Cirrus SR-22, these are mega leaps from traditionally designed airplanes. And so the first recommendation I made is that we need to commit ourselves to no less than 25 hours of intensive transition training when moving into these airplanes. Now, whether or not that needs to be made as a logbook endorsement, as such as is required for a tailwheel, I find transitioning to a tailwheel is far easier than transitioning to some of these fast glass airplanes, but we don't have that kind of an endorsement required. That's number one. Number two, I think if we're going to move into these airplanes, these fast glass airplanes, we really need to think about committing ourselves to a weekly flying schedule, not a monthly schedule. Anybody who's learned and flies a multi-engine aircraft knows that that's a license to kill if we do not maintain our proficiency, if we do not fly those airplanes on a regular basis. Number three, I think that anybody who is flying for the first time these new fast glass airplanes, they really ought to get at least 50 hours of PIC time in VFR conditions. They need to understand those systems, and they need to understand them intuitively and innately, so that when things do go wrong in IMC for the first time, at least they have some experiential basis to build up a solution. In the two fatals that I referred to in this article, that two friends that I lost, they both occurred when the pilots suddenly entered IFR conditions. And again, they were both experienced pilots. Lastly, once we've developed a proficiency on the gauges or on the glass, I think we have to really condition ourselves to be flying six approaches, simulated or real, every month, not every 6 months as required by the regulation. And if a month goes by, we haven't practiced six approaches, either simulated or real, then I think it's incumbent upon us to go out and find a safety pilot and get that approach before entering IMC for the next time. You know, these are not terribly onerous requirements. 25 hours of transition training, even at the cost of that compared to the cost of the airplane, is minuscule. If you're going to buy and spend that much money on an airplane, then fly it frequently. If it's sitting in the hangar, you know, for a month or more, it's just a great big, very expensive paperweight. And then lastly, and this is in review, if we're going to go into IFR conditions, IFR flying, things can happen very fast and they can go out of control very fast. It just requires a higher level of proficiency and maintenance of proficiency.
All right. Now, you had a statement, a comment, and I'm going to quote from your newsletter here, that factory training targets aircraft systems rather than basic airmanship skills. Was this statement based on a knowledge of these programs or an assumption based on what we see in the proficiency of people coming through them?
No, both. I've been through factory training, and I've been on factory training through on several aircraft, and I know exactly what we spend time on. We spend time on systems. We spend time on understanding the buttons, the technology in the cockpit. We understand and you know, really take apart the electrical system and how to shed load and things like that. All of the factory training has to do with that make model airplane. It has nothing to do with steep turns, slow flight, stall recovery, crosswind landings. The factories assume that their customers know how to fly the airplanes. And in 2 or 3 days, half the time is spent in the classroom. And half of that classroom training, all the classroom training, again, is on the aircraft systems, as is the flight portion. You know, let me just say parenthetically, I used to assume that individuals who received effective primary training that were destined to the airlines or corporate, they would be okay pilots because the corporate flight departments and airline flight departments would straighten out any omissions. But I've come to find out, talking with folks going through that training is not addressing basic airmanship issues. It's training, you know, systems in larger aircraft. So the same is true. This really adds to the importance of primary training, primacy of learning. What we learn or don't learn at that primary level will carry on all the way through our entire flying career, whether it's buying a new fast glass airplane or transitioning up a career ladder into the airliners. If you don't know that stall speed increases with bank angle, the factory's not going to teach you that.
Well, Bob, as always, we'll refer folks to the newsletter, the May edition of Over the Airwaves, and we look forward to talking to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Bob.
You can read Bob Miller's Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, at www.overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.